On Education and Workforce Development to order. We have a lengthy agenda. It looks like a session's worth of bills on one day, but God willing, we'll get through what we have to get through. I want to start off with Senate Bill 931, then go into public hearings and work sessions on the Superintendent of Public Instruction bill. We'll be hearing more than one of those bills, but we will be doing a work session on Senate Bill 552. We will hopefully be moving into a work session on Senate Bill 602 if we get the papers in the next hour. And we'll have a public hearing and work session, possible work session on Senate Bill 240. And then we will go into about five department bills, the 20s, as I can call them, 22 through 27. And we will carry over Senate Bill 21 to another day. So with that, I'd like to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 931. And why don't you give us a summary on that?
Brief summary. Senate Bill 931 grants part-time faculty at community colleges preference for reemployment when new employment opportunities for which part-time faculty is qualified become available, declares an emergency.
Okay. I have Rob Redner, John Wyckoff, Jerry Donnelly, Rosemary Teeter, Andrew Bone. So why don't we do separate panels?
Perfect.
With the Wagner team up first.
Perfect.
And the community college team up second.
Thanks, Senator.
Chair Hask, members of the committee, for the record, Rob Wagner representing the American Federation of Teachers, Oregon. I know you have a busy agenda today, so we will keep our comments limited. I've submitted written testimony for your review. I just wanted to highlight at the 10,000-foot level what we're going to be talking about today, and then we also have two bills up down in the House Higher Education Subcommittee that are related to this topic. All of this is around an issue of what's happened with staffing in our academic institutions over the last 30 years. A lot of it has stemmed from the disinvestment in of public post-secondary higher education. And what's really happened is that there's been a trend from hiring full-time tenure-track faculty at our community colleges and universities toward hiring more contingent, adjunct, part-time faculty. And the bill that's so this is part of a national campaign called the Faculty and College Excellence Act. The first part of that campaign was a bill that we actually passed with all 30 members of the Senate last legislative session. It was House Bill 2557. It's included in the testimony that I've distributed to you today, which adopted the principles of the FACE campaign into statute and then set up some opportunities for adjunct faculty to have access to more affordable health insurance benefits and set up some reporting requirements. This is a continuation of that conversation. And really, what's happened is that with this shift, we see more and more part-time faculty that teach at multiple institutions, and some of them are going to be telling their stories today. It's an exceedingly demanding life. And this is the first attempt at looking at legislation that would provide some consistent job reliability for faculty who are teaching multiple sections over multiple years to know that they have the promise or the potential of future employment. So we are very cognizant of the budget crisis that Oregon is facing, especially today, since we're right now downstairs in the basement. There's some numbers being thrown around. But we wanted to do raise the attention of what's happening with faculty staffing issues and the attention on this issue. So we stand ready to work with anyone to make this a better bill. We know it's not perfect, but we definitely would love to engage in conversation with community colleges on this issue and move forward productively this session if possible. And with that, I'll turn it over to David Reeves, AFT Oregon's president.
Good afternoon, Chair Hass, members of the committee. My name's David Reeves. I'm president of the American Federation of Teachers, Oregon. AFT Oregon represents thousands of workers in schools, community colleges, and universities throughout Oregon. Today, I'm offering testimony in support of Senate Bill 931 to establish some kind of reliability in assignments for contingent faculty, community colleges. We're pleased to see that Oregon is taking student success seriously. Some of the bills this committee has already discussed previously. And that's why we can't ignore what's going on in instructional staffing at our colleges. Oregon has the goal of 40-40-20. That means 80% of all Oregonians will have earned a college or university certificate or diploma by 2025. Our legislature is focused on the need for quality education to meet the demands of the 21st century. SB 931 is about the quality of education. You know, the number of adjunct faculty teaching at community colleges has risen tremendously just in the last two decades. Adjunct faculty teach over half the classes at most colleges in the state. For example, at PCC, Portland Community College, they teach 65% of the classes at the college, adjunct faculty. In face of decreasing funding, college administrators have more and more relied on low-paid, temporary, assigned, contingent faculty. Now, I'm not referring to the occasional academic or professional who moonlights to teach a class. I'm talking about many of the adjunct positions that are filled by career teachers that cobble together assignments at multiple campuses and colleges every term. These are, you know, if you look at the numbers of the departments, the community colleges with the highest number of adjunct contingent faculty, they are English, developmental ed, GED, ESL, math, things like that. They're not the professional trades programs. So this really career teachers, maybe you've heard the term freeway flyer in reference to these teachers that go from campus to campus, college to college, trying to put together some kind of workload each term. Many of them don't have a contract. They have to wait each and every term for a new assignment. It's hard to participate in the college. There's a lot of hustling around to get your assignments each and every term so you have a decent workload. So this is the working conditions we're talking about in our colleges. At the same time, we're stressing student retention and student success. You know, some industries operate with a high percentage of temp workers, you know, constantly churning temporary workers over. I don't think these are businesses we necessarily associate with high quality, and I don't think these are the working conditions that really lead to student retention and success. We'd like to keep and develop excellent teachers who have demonstrated their excellence in the classroom. All we want with SB 931 is the chance to offer these teachers some reliability in getting their assignments from term to term. It's not the system we have now. You know, the benefits of Senate Bill 931 to students is clear. Instead of driving around from one class to another, instructors can have a little chance of assurance that they'll be at their college more often and available to students. An instructor could teach an entire sequence throughout the year, Physics 101, 102, 103, that doesn't necessarily go on now. Students would have some continuity in learning. With a class like physics, you get a lot of students that are a little bit intimidated by it. It's somewhat daunting to them. I don't know if you can remember way back when you were in college, maybe a 101, 102, 103 sequence you were in that was a little bit difficult at the time. It's having some kind of continuity with the teacher throughout the year really adds to the students being able to succeed and meet the challenges of that material. I don't know if you've seen the college schedules lately, but to be announced is not something any student really looks forward to when they're choosing a class and instructor for that class, the instructor being to be announced. So as student retention is becoming a major issue in this state, I think we have to also talk about instructor retention. I think there's a direct connection. The one person that the student has the most contact with is the teacher. These are individuals who advise and coach students to overcome their barriers and succeed. In turn, instructors should be able to expect some kind of reliability in their assignments from term to term. The AFT, along with other education groups, has urged policymakers to resolve this staffing crisis we face in higher education. We're not asking for a guarantee of work. There will always be ups and downs with enrollment and funding. We just want an opportunity for a career track for instructors who have dedicated themselves to our colleges and our students. I urge you to support Senate Bill 931.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chairman and Committee. Thank you for taking your time to listen to us today. My name is Wendy Conley. I am a faculty member at Portland Community College. I teach biology. And I want you to know that I am not here as an advocate for part-time faculty. I am here as an advocate for educational quality. To let you know a little bit about my credentials, I have taught for Portland Community College for 7 years. Two of those years have been as temporary full-time, so I've seen it from both sides. I'm passionate about educational quality for students, partly because I realize how vital it is for our country to maintain global competitiveness. But also, as a biology teacher, my students are future nurses, doctors, pharmacists, and emergency medical technicians. Incompetence in my students, when they go on to their professional lives, kills people. So I'm very, very passionate and feel very strongly about this issue. In addition to having taught for 7 years, I have also been very active in improving pedagogy at my campus and improving the science of teaching and the methodology of teaching. So I have some knowledge around this issue. I jokingly call myself a poster child for part-time faculty because I have taught the maximum that I could get every year for 7 years, every term, summers, because I need that to fill in to keep some income going. So I'm quite knowledgeable and experienced in this area. I would like to define the effects of the lack of consistency on educational quality and on students, and then discuss the connection between the lack of consistency and educational quality, and I will be brief. Under the current system, part-time faculty, as David said, never know how many classes they're going to get from term to term. This lack of consistency in classroom assignments causes them to load up on as many classes as they can get and at multiple colleges. The result of this is teachers who spend hours commuting between campuses, I have been there, and reinventing the wheel for classes that are new to them or that they may only teach occasionally. This is time that could be spent giving students what they need. David mentioned the fact that it cuts into face-to-face time for students. It cuts in many, many areas. The average full-time faculty member teaches the same three or four different classes year after year. They have time and resources available to them to refine and improve those classes. As part-time faculty, I teach 8 different classes at 2 different campuses, which have different versions of those same classes. So if you look at it, I teach 16 different classes. And it is sometimes months or even years between teaching the same class for me. The breadth of those classes means that I have little opportunity to refine and add depth to my classes. And as a serious educator, I find that painful. Consistency would allow me to focus on depth and quality for a smaller number of classes and improve the outcome for my students. Consistency connects to educational quality in the fact that research shows that student performance depends heavily on the amount and depth of feedback that they receive from their teachers. And I can tell you that depth of feedback requires many, many hours. Each instructor, full-time or part-time, spends hours more. For every classroom hour, there are many hours spent grading and giving depth of feedback. Teachers who are confident in their scheduling know what is going to be happening. They create substantive assignments. They give carefully considered feedback, both written and face-to-face, and they write challenging exams. overextended teachers, by necessity, give assignments and exams that are quick to grade and require little feedback. This produces an inferior educational outcome. Good part-time faculty will give as much time as they possibly can to analyzing student work, but it's extremely difficult under these circumstances. Just to give you an example from this previous term, for me, I had, in addition to my other classes, I had three classes of majors biology with five-page term papers, in addition to many other assignments I had to grade. I spent, during finals week, I spent 30 hours grading assignments for just those three labs out of five classes I teach total. In striving for the highest in educational quality, my view is that the ideal is a staff of full-time faculty who have the experience and resources to become well-developed professionals with just enough part-time faculty to cover uncertainties in enrollment. The antithesis of that is to have the majority of classes taught by large numbers of part-time faculty of varying experience and varying ability who spend time and resources running on a treadmill just trying to keep up and never having the opportunity to instill depth into their classes. In my department, biology at Sylvania campus of Portland Community College, in the fall term of this year, there were 9 full-time permanent faculty, 41 part-time faculty. 82% of the faculty in my department are part-time. In addition, there's 2, myself and one other, who are in the limbo of temporary full-time. I have the luxury that I've been given a second year full-time next year. After that, I have no idea what's going to happen, and I am a career teacher. I plan to stick it out, but not everybody can. Tight budgets, we know, necessitate a compromise that will maintain a high level of instructional quality while minimally increasing expenditure. The solution, I think, lies in having experienced part-time faculty who have enough consistency in their schedules to allow them to focus on providing students with the things they need. This lack of consistency for 82% of faculty means that the vast majority of our classes fall into that worst-case scenario, and that causes public colleges to become more shallow, whereas if we were able to have put depth into the classes, we would improve the outcome. I recently heard a student just last week expressing envy of a friend who attends Merrillhurst. Her friend was very enthusiastic because her classes involve substantive academic relationships with her teachers. She feels mentored and challenged and encouraged. The majority of our students aren't receiving that because part-time faculty are bearing a burden that then impacts the students. Consistency for part-time faculty will go a long way toward improving educational quality. And I would like to put something in for my department chair who asked me to say something before I came down here today. She wanted also to add that retaining quality part-time faculty is very difficult because the part-time faculty have no idea what's coming next. And so they give up and they go on to other jobs. They go on to non-teaching jobs. And we sometimes have trouble finding qualified part-time faculty. And they leave. And this impacts how many classes we're able to offer at a time when our enrollment is up 30%. It has impacts that reverberate throughout the system. Thank you for your time and attention.
Well, we thank you. I don't know how you do that. 16 classes.
Thank you.
We have some freeway flyers up here every day, I-5 to the Capitol. Any questions for our panel?
Yeah, it's very important.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I have to get back to class.
Class, yeah. And the community colleges, John Wyckoff's team.
Chair Haas and members of the committee, my name is Rosemary Teeter. I've been an adjunct faculty member at Clackamas Community College for 10 years, and for the last 6 years has been my honor and privilege to represent between 300 and 400 adjunct faculty members. I teach primarily GED and adult basic education, and right now my students are on break, but they'll come back to math. I come before you today to speak in favor of Senate Bill 931. At Clackamas, we've had a little bit of experience with what can happen when something like this is in place. And I know that Mount Hood Community College and PCC both have assignment rights for a portion of their adjunct faculty group. This is based on longevity, hours of teaching credit, favorable reviews. So there's some experience out there that will tell you that this can work. What does it provide for adjuncts? In a word, stability. Knowing from one term to the next what you're going to be doing and where you're going to be allows for things like child care provisions and knowing when you'll be home at night, being able to plan a family budget, because income becomes more stable as well. I was a freeway flyer in the beginning. I'm grateful to say that I've been able to support myself at Clackamas for the last few years. Imagine, however, if you served in the Senate for 10, 15, maybe even 20 years, and you were never able to get the committees you wanted. That's adjunct faculty.
You're describing Senator George here, but go ahead.
That's what adjunct faculty face. Full-time faculty get choices based on their seniority, but adjunct faculty often do not. And as was stated before, I'm not going to go into her vivid description of how unstable it can be, because it really is like that. What I did also want to say is things like expanding teaching skills, taking advantage of professional development. You have to stay in one place for a little while to do that. If you're running from one college or campus to the next, you're out the door before students have 5 minutes to catch you, and you can't put it in your schedule to take advantage of a webinar on Friday morning at 10 a.m., even though your association, my association, provides a stipend for that. It just isn't there. Professional development and improvement of teaching is something that is a far-off, distant dream for us. Do you recall when you were in college, you took a class because you knew the instructor was good, either by reputation or you'd had that person before? If the schedule says TBA or staff, which most of them do, students have a hard time having any continuity with instructors. In foundational classes, as was mentioned before, where you have a sequence, having continuity with the same person over that sequence can mean the difference between succeeding or dropping out. We can retain students simply because they can get the same instructor term to term. And that really is, I'm not going to repeat what was said before because it's all valid. Do you have any questions?
Questions? Committee? Comments? Ms. Teeter, thank you.
You're welcome.
And now the community colleges, John Wyckoff, team.
Chair House, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Wyckoff. I'm the legislative director for the Oregon Community College Association. And with me today, we have a slight change from the list I had given you earlier. We have with me today Scott Huff from Portland Community College and Andrew Bone from Chemeketa. Jerry Donnelly is in House Higher Ed on similar issues, but with different bill numbers. I just want to start, I'm going to speak briefly and then let these two gentlemen who both work on campuses directly with this issue talk in more detail. The Oregon Community College Association is opposed to this legislation. In effect, this is a one-size-fits-all mandate that would affect each of our campuses differently. Part of that being that the issues here are dealt with in local collective bargaining agreements that will have different definitions of what part-time is at each campus, that will have that will look at this issue. Many of these campuses will already have some sort of priority list, but they will they'll do it differently based on collective bargaining agreements. This legislation looks at disciplines in relation to how you make this list, where a lot of the campuses in their collective bargaining agreements will actually do it by course. So this would change the agreements done in collective bargaining for each of the campuses to a one-size-fits-all scheme that that we believe should still remain in collective bargaining. It would also expand the time that faculty would stay on this list from what the most expansive of the list would be, which is about a year, whereas under the legislation it would double that time to 24 months. It would also just undermine the local governance of the colleges where they are currently able to do this, again, as I said, in collective bargaining, where we think it's appropriate to have these discussions. And so with that, I will turn it over to my two colleagues who can talk more about this and how it deals with
Chair Haas, members of the committee, my name is Scott Huff. I am an instructional administrator at Portland Community College. I'm also here representing the Oregon Council of Instructional Administrators at the 17 community colleges around the state. Part-time faculty are critical to our success. We cannot deliver the education that we do without them, and within the bounds of our funding that we have available to us, we want to do as best as we can for each of them. Senate Bill 931 has good intentions, but we have concerns. One of which is that it would undo or change the way much of the good work already being done by community colleges, some of which have considered time and service already, providing, as has been stated here earlier, some guarantee of work at various colleges, some for a course, some in a discipline, and also having impact on the rate of pay by staying on for more years. So as has been stated, I'm going to use the one-size-fits-all, say that one-size-fits-all approach really does not work well. We've had a lot of years' experience with negotiating with our faculty federations, and we have gotten to good places. We really don't want to undo some of that. It's really best handled as local consideration for each of the 17 community colleges and the bargaining units there, where bargaining units exist, recognizing that some don't. Proposed bill would have an impact on those collective bargaining agreements, which are as varied as the 17 community colleges. And from a standpoint of scheduling, it's been discussed earlier about by the faculty members who've spoken about the desire to teach in sequences and things, so that students have some consistency from term to term. To a large extent, that is done and is done often as much as possible. I really urge you to reject Senate Bill 931 and leave it for the local community college boards, all 17 of them, to deal with as they go through collective bargaining negotiations or conversations with faculty members where those collective bargaining agreements don't exist. Thank you for your time.
Chair Haas, committee members, my name for the record is Andrew Bone. I have responsibilities at Chemeketa for employee relations, which includes negotiating our collective bargaining agreements. I've been at Chemeketa for 17 years, for 10 of those years, quite proudly on the full-time faculty at Chemeketa for the past 7 years in my current role. Prior to coming to Chemeketa, I spent 4 or 5 years at a variety of community colleges being a freeway flyer, and I very much appreciate any efforts to improve the system and remember those days when it was very difficult. I think it's helpful for everyone to understand the size and complexity of our community colleges. We hear that word community and we think it's a little neighborhood organization, and many of us, including myself, have fond memories of them.
we have at Chemeketa approximately 220 full-time faculty. We have approximately 500 part-time faculty. In a typical term, we schedule over 3,000 sections of courses at a variety of locations. This is no small logistical task. The processes we have in place got there through decades of collective bargaining. This bill would, quite frankly, upset those decades of collective bargaining. Our collective bargaining agreement has a process that already describes how courses are assigned to full-time and to part-time. You've heard comments earlier from people talking about how difficult that life is as a part-time faculty member. It is also competitive because we have difficulty finding good part-time faculty members. We have to remain competitive, and we do that through our collective bargaining agreements. This bill would simply remove that ability for us to try to be competitive. We are currently in bargaining with our faculty. One of the issues on the table is the rights of part-time faculty for continued employment. In my reading of this bill, this gives part-time faculty members a legal right to continued employment. That is a very big issue to give away. We are open to, and we expect to get from our faculty, a proposal that will establish some limited rights that are described in this bill. But we're not opposed to it at all, but we want to consider the entire implications of that bill. This bill, if it were enacted, would strip away the college's ability to negotiate. It would have to just accept what's given, and that would be a very, very detrimental thing in our view. The other serious problem I have with this bill is it gives seniority based on a discipline. I'm going to use our human services program as an example. And I use that program because they have a very specialized course on infectious disease control. They have an adjunct person who comes in who's very specialized, and that's the only course they teach, that person teaches. Under this bill, that person would have the right to teach any class in that department. The converse would also be true. If a part-time faculty person taught a lower level class, a more generalized course, if they did it long enough, they would have rights to that very specialized course over the top of a specialist. So that's the kind of havoc that this would cause to our institution. Again, our process is not perfect, but it is the result of collective bargaining, a process that I fully support and feel that good things come of it. Having it legislated, in my view, would cause us to almost have to renegotiate our entire faculty contract. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, gentlemen. I appreciate your comments, but the testimony earlier suggests that for one reason or another, the collective bargaining process isn't working, and that we have ended up with what we have, with teachers teaching 16 different classes that, you know, going from school to school. And I know you say that this should be left to the collective bargaining in the local districts. If it is, then why isn't it working?
I think one of the earlier people actually testified more to the point that it was a function of our budget situation. If we could afford it, we would hire many, many full-time. The fact of the matter is our budget situation doesn't allow it. So the next best thing, it seems to me, is to fall back to that collective bargaining agreements. One of the other problems I have with the bill, I didn't have time to make enough phone calls, but it does not address a community college that may not have represented part-time faculty members. So I don't know what would happen to that. It was just a question I had as I read the bill. I didn't see any provisions for a part-time group that's not represented by a union, so I'm not sure what would happen there.
Okay. Questions, comments?
Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you. To close the public hearing on the Senate bill on 931, we have a kind of a confluence of different bills coming here. I have different state senators or different bills. Senator Berger, we have the superintendent's bill before you, and I have Senator Edwards here, but I'd be happy to change that order to...
Whatever you'd like.
Okay. Well, let's do that then. Can you get Senator Atkinson? He said to give him a call. Let's open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 240 and go to cyberbullying. And Senator Atkinson is en route, and Senator Berger is here. You can give us a summary, Linda.
Yes. Senate Bill 240 requires school districts to develop the policy prohibiting harassment, intimidation, or bullying, and prohibiting cyberbullying after consultation with parents, guardians, school employees, volunteers, students, administrators, and community representatives. It requires school employees to report hostile acts, allows remedial action for failure to report, allows voluntary and anonymous reporting by students or volunteers, allows increased remedial actions if conspiracy or subsequent similar acts happen, and requires the school to predominantly post the policy, and requires school or district to report to law enforcement incidents that violate criminal statutes.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much for this public hearing. My name is Joanne Berger, and I'm the senator from District 5. Members of the committee, the reason that you have this bill before you today is because of a young woman named Phoebe Prince. I read about Phoebe Prince. She came to a new school. She was very pretty. One of the boys, popular boys at school, thought she was pretty too, and he began to date her. And they dated for about 3 months. But the mean girls didn't think that was a great idea because she wasn't a member of the in-group. And so they began to harass Phoebe through cyberbullying. They were on Facebook. She couldn't get away from them. They were on her cell phone. And finally, they kept telling her, "You just need to kill yourself." So she did. She hung herself with the scarf that her sister had given her for Christmas. Phoebe Prince should be alive today. There should not be any reason that our children, our young people, cannot go to school in a safe and healthy environment. Now, Chair Hass, we've had bullying on the school grounds, and I've been working on that for the last several years. In all of your schools today, you will see big signs of what you're supposed to do on the school ground and within school. This is a new kind of bullying. This is a more vicious kind of bullying. And we have, very fortunately here today, an expert and a person who has studied cyberbullying, is a national speaker, is a writer of books on the subject, and is going to testify. I'm going to ask Senator Monica Sanderson if she would like to say a few words in support of the bill before we introduce our expert here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Senator Lori Monas Anderson. I represent Gresham, Troutdale, Wood Village, and Fairview, and I'm delighted to speak to you about Senate Bill 240. Schools are currently encouraged to have a policy, and although I hate mandates, Senate Bill 240 would make it a requirement. And the reason I truly feel that this needs to be a requirement is all schools should have this policy, and a parent should not be concerned about different bullying techniques. It would require school employees to report harassment, intimidation, bullying, or cyberbullying, and provides consequences for failure to report. It really creates, this bill creates a proactive approach to bullying and cyberbullying. Cyberbullying has led to suicides, and it is my belief that if we put a strong policy in place, this could avoid this thing. So, thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Atkinson, I was wondering if you could come up on this bill and perhaps introduce our cyber expert.
Thank you for the record, Mr. Chair. I'm Jason Atkinson. I represent a good portion of Southern Oregon, and I am here to support Senator Verger and this effort. I was in the hall about a half an hour ago, and someone who used to work here, who no longer does, but just happened to be visiting old friends, asked me, what are you waiting to testify on? And I told her this particular bill and what it related to. And for the for about 10 minutes, we talked about her bullying experience, switching schools, and the absolute fear that person had lived in during her high school career. It is stories like that and the passion of Senator Verger that brings this to me. As I spoke about earlier, my friend on the right, Mr. Coughlin, who is a best-selling author on a variety of subjects, really has, in his own practice, taken up the banner of the unsung heroes, and those are the children who stand up to bullies, and created something called the Protectors. And then in his lack of judgment, called me and asked me, how do I set up a nonprofit to do all this? And foolishly, I agreed to help, and now I'm on his board. But I think what you'll see in his testimony, I hope, is something that is not as straightforward as we might think. It's not as kind and gentle as you might think. But It harkens back to a day when you actually stood up for those who don't have a voice. And it is with that interest and my esteem for my colleague from Coos County that I'm here and would just like to serve as a reference for the Protectors. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Chair Hass, and members of the committee. This is a tremendous opportunity to speak to you about something that is a growing problem across the United States and in Oregon as well. Before I get there, I do want to thank my senators here for their invitation to be here and education on this topic as it relates to Oregon statute. My name is Paul Coughlin. I'm founder and president of the Protectors, where we provide freedom from bullying and courage and character for life. You have before you a four-page War and Peace article that I wrote for my testimony. I will put you at ease right away. I will not read the entire thing during this presentation, but I'm going to tease just a few thoughts out of it. The world of bullying has changed dramatically. When I was a kid, when most of us here were kids, we would go to school, we would get picked on, and then we could go home, and there our children, or rather our parents, would treat us like Humpty Dumpty. They would put us back together again. They would patch up the broken parts of us, whether that be physical or psychological, send us back into the new day of another day at school to be tormented by a minority of students who bully. Unfortunately, those days have ended. They've gotten worse in the age of cyberbullying. Now children are literally being bullied 24/7. Senator Verger talked about Phoebe Prince. She's just one who has actually made the papers. There are so many more who haven't made the papers, and the parents have worked hard to keep their child's name out of the paper, who committed bullycide, suicide, due to ongoing campaigns of cruelty. They're being, like Phoebe Prince, bullied on the way home from school. They're getting text messages saying, why don't you kill yourself, you Irish slut. They said Irish whore to her in text messages and on Facebook. And then after Phoebe Prince took her life with her sister's scarf in January, hung herself in the stairway. They said on her Facebook page, mission accomplished. One of the seven people brought up on both state and federal charges. When we think of cyberbullying and what it does, those of us in the Freedom from Bullying movement, we believe it is greatly associated with an increase in bullycide. And the reason why, it's very similar to why the elderly
may die during heat waves. Experts tell us that it is not the daytime high that kills the elderly. It is the nighttime high. They can't get away from the heat. Likewise, with children who are subjected to ongoing campaigns of cruelty that we call cyberbullying that sears their psychological flesh from their body. They can't get away from the heat. It's very similar to how Martin Luther King described segregation. He talked about the fatigue of despair, and after a while, people just gave up hope for a better life. They gave up hope for justice and freedom. Likewise, targets of cyberbullying, they just give up hope after a while. And frankly, all of us in this room, most of us in this room would do the same thing. If you were followed home from work and picked on in text messages on Facebook and people slander, well, actually that probably does happen from time to time being a government figure, but imagine being a private citizen and this happens over and over and over again. They simply give up hope. We think about Tyler Clemente, the Rutgers freshman, who on September 2nd of last year at 8:42 p.m. posted on Facebook that he was going to jump off the George Washington Bridge. Probably all familiar with him. And it was his bully side that brought about some of the most sweeping legislation there in New Jersey to take care of the issue of cyberbullying, to push back. He was caught on tape in sexual relations with another man, and this was held against him. It was a deliberate campaign of cruelty to deliberately humiliate him. Cyberbullying is not accidental. It is not a coincidence. It is on purpose. It is highly predatory toward another person. Much of it is illegal. And in fact, we should probably change the term cyberbullying and call it what it really is, pre-criminal behavior. Unfortunately, many of Oregon's students, they don't have much of a voice in those situations. I've talked about Tyler Clemente. We've talked about Phoebe Prince. Let me talk about a young man named Cole in Alabama, who I will be probably going to by the end of the school year. I'll be speaking at his school. Cole was a 14-year-old boy, and he was being cyberbullied on Facebook by a group of girls. And they were saying awful, slanderous things about him, things that I probably shouldn't repeat. He went to his parents on Sunday, and he said, Mom, Dad, I can't go to school. I just can't go. I can't face these people anymore. They were actually doing extortion toward him as well. All of this on Facebook. And in text messaging. And his parents said, no, you got to go. You got to cowboy up. You got to go to school. So he said, okay. Well, you know, it's easy to be courageous during the day, and at nighttime he was fearful. And the next day he was in the car with his mother. And he said, Mom, I can't go to school. And she said, we got to go. We got to go. I'm late for work. And he said, well, okay. And he said, oh, Mom, I forgot to brush my teeth. She says, all right. And so he goes inside, goes upstairs and grabs his father's .22 rifle, puts it in his mouth, and takes his own life. He never made the paper. At the Protectors, he's not the only one we've heard from. We hear from this over and over and over. In our own backyard, Southern Oregon, I worked with a mother who another child created a false Facebook page. And then from there, attacked her daughter, actually pretended to be her daughter, and said horrible things designed to get this girl in trouble. The second thing I'd like to impress upon you is the highly predatory nature of bullying. Contrary to what many of us have been taught, it is not about conflict. It is not about anger management or miscommunication. It is about disdain and contempt for another human being. Most bullies do not possess low self-esteem. They possess excessive self-esteem. And because of that, they are very hard to reach. They, unfortunately, they don't listen much to peace, love, and understanding. They listen to power. A child identified as a serial bully as young as third grade is five times more likely to commit a major crime by their middle 20s than their peers. They are four times more likely to abuse their future spouse and children. Bullies listen to power. You have the capacity to bring that power to bear against them. And then the third point I'd like to make is I'm confident that there are already schools that have incorporated the wording in this proposed legislation. I've worked with some of them. There's a fantastic middle school, Ashland Middle School, in Southern Oregon. I've worked with the two principals. And together we created a freedom from bullying commitment that you'll see if you walk in the front doors. They are committed professionals. They care deeply about this issue. They love these children and they want to bring them justice. And I can also tell you that there are schools in Oregon that are not as committed. I'm not sure why. And because of that, I think it's absolutely essential that there be legislation that puts everyone on the same page. Sure, some are already doing it. I can tell you from letters from many parents and actually teachers that some are not. So I urge you to support this proposed legislation. It would be my privilege to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Your book is fascinating here. I noticed that a lot of it, maybe most of it, is sort of advice for parents and what to do, what not to do, stories. And it makes a lot of sense. Do you think government can get to the means that you're advocating here? I mean, you've read the bill that's before us. Will this do the trick? There's a couple of these cyberbullying bills in this legislature, and I'm just wondering your thoughts on this bill and if this is really something that makes us all feel better or think we've done something, or does it fall short, or is there something different?
Well, thank you, Chair. It's a fantastic question. It goes back to something that Senator Atkins said earlier. This is a complex issue. I'm going to predict that you will be revisiting this issue for years to come, especially in issues of freedom of speech and cyberbullying, for one, sexting, the transmission of sexual images, whether or not that fits child pornography laws or breaks child pornography laws. To go to the bulk of your question, this is a piece in a very large puzzle. Actually, I'll use a different terminology. Bullying is really a riddle. It is not a puzzle. There is an answer. But we have to use ingenuity, we have to use wisdom, and we have to use a whole lot of courage in helping these children who are the subjects of an ongoing campaign of cruelty against them. This is certainly a move in the right direction, and at the Protectors, we wholeheartedly support it, but would certainly love to work with the committee in the future if and when this issue arises, or actually when this issue arises in the future.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Questions or comments? Senator Bonamici?
No, Mr. Chair, thank you so much for bringing this forward and for your passionate testimony. I was asking the chair if there's somebody else who's going to sort of clarify, because we did pass a bill last session that requires schools to adopt a policy on cyberbullying. So I'm trying to figure out what the difference is in these new requirements. Is it an additional requirement to what we passed last session?
I think the main difference is that it mandates it. It was very interesting when I brought this bill forward. I had advice from two sides. One from one of my colleagues who said, Joanne, don't make this bill too stringent, because there are people that are just kidding around and you don't want to have them labeled as some bad person in the criminal courts. Mm-hmm. And then there were other people that said to me, one other person said, in order to really get to this, you've got to really do something to the people that are doing it. I think maybe after meeting Paul Coughlin, I felt more satisfied with this bill, because his program is to teach children how to handle it rather than going to the person that's doing the bullying. It's to teach children how to take care of the bullies and to understand the seriousness and to understand who they are. And so I don't feel that it's as soft. I worried that it was too soft, but now I feel better about it after having met him.
Thank you, Senator.
Chair Hass, if I could add one more comment there. Schools will be unable to answer the problem of adolescent bullying on their own, largely because of the predatory nature of bullying. It is highly secretive. Bullies go shopping in September, and usually by October they have found their targets. They are highly selective of who they attack, when they attack them, and how they attack them. One study in Canada asked five schools to identify a bully, targets, and bystanders, and they mixed them all up so they had never met each other. So they would take a bully from this school, pair him with a target from this school, and maybe some bystanders over here. Within 2 hours, every bully found every previous target. They look for a certain personality type. And so, to answer the question a little more fully, we need to get the bystander involved in what we call the theater of bullying. They need training to become what we call an alongside stander. Because given the secretive nature of bullying, about the only way that schools are going to be able to diminish it to any substantial degree would be to create a police state, where you would have video, audio of sodium pentothal, you would have lie detector tests. I mean, you would have to create an amazing police state in order to really have authority alone fix this problem. But if you can get the bystander to stand by the target with assertive but nonviolent words, much in the tradition of the noble civil rights movement under Martin Luther King, because this is a civil rights issue, now you're cooking with gas. Now you can make a tremendous difference in what we call the theater of bullying.
All right.
Thank you,
Mr. Chairman, again for having us.
Senator Atkinson. I do have Lori Satinspiel signed up to speak next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Lori Satinspiel, Oregon School Boards. And yes, Senator Bonamici, last session we passed House Bill 2599, and I think the media touted it as Oregon having the best bullying laws on file. And the bill already does require districts to have a policy. And we have written a couple of versions of policy, and I brought a couple with me today, and I can provide that electronically at a later date if that is helpful for you. Our policy does call out identified person that will take reports, investigate, report back to parents on investigations. The policy also requires reporting. The concerns that we might have with Senate Bill 240, cyberbullying, usually is off campus, and that does require, we'd have a hard time dealing with that unless those acts came to the campus. So we continue to work with that. House Bill last session 2599 required training for teachers, students, parents, and that's ongoing in the district. On page 2, line 15, I'm not sure that we have the level of knowledge of law enforcement to know when we've violated a criminal statute, and I would be concerned about that. And I think those are, if it goes to an assault, that's pretty easily tossed over to law enforcement to deal with. So I would just raise that as an issue. And again, we continue to work with this issue. I know it's a problem, and one of our major concerns for districts is to have safe school environments, and we'll continue to work with this issue as what was previously testified to. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions?
I just have a quick question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Lori, I don't know if maybe you can answer this for me, or maybe somebody else can get the information for me. You said something about having a hard time dealing with the issue if it's done off campus. Is that a legal requirement, or where does that conflict come from? Because I remember hearing that with one of the districts in the district I represent, one of the school districts had a problem with somebody who had something on a website that was done off school premises at his home and not brought into the school, and it ended up in litigation, and it was protracted and went on for a long time, and I don't remember exactly the resolution, but is there a legal barrier to the school doing something about something that the student does off campus, and is that better handled by law enforcement?
I believe there is, and I would have to get back with you on that. I know in some of the references to bus stops, again, those are considered off-campus, and we'd have trouble supervising things that went on there.
Just a follow-up, Mr. Chair. I just want to make sure that, you know, it's a really serious issue, and the testimony was really compelling. I just want to make sure that we're approaching it the way that we can get results that we're looking
for. I totally
agree. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you. All right. Thanks to everyone who... is there anyone else who is here on 240? I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 240. Our thanks to Mr. Cockman and Senator Verger and those who testified on this. Mm-hmm. I want to go into the superintendent's bills here. We have three of them. And I'm going to open up a simultaneous public hearing on Senate Bill 552, Senate Bill 170, Senate Joint Resolution 4. And on the Senate Joint Resolution 4, Senator Cruz is here to speak to that. And Senator, thanks for your patience. Have a busy day here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Let me do a summary first.
Jeff Cruz, Senate District 1. Let you do your thing.
Excuse me, sir. I was just going to do a quick summary. Senate Joint Resolution 4 proposes an amendment to the Oregon Constitution creating a State Board of Education, directs the State Board of Education to appoint Superintendent of Public Instructions, provides for termination of elected office of the Superintendent of Public Instruction on January 4, 2015, and the beginning of the office of appointed Superintendent of Public Instruction on January 5, 2015. And this proposed amendment is referred to the people for their approval or rejection at the next general election. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator.
Okay. Once again, Senator Jeff Cruz, Senate District 1. I was interested in the last discussion. It was deja vu back to last session. So I want to talk because SJR 4 and Senate Bill 170 are tied. The two need to go together. The passage of the constitutional amendment would trigger the other bill. But let me give you a little brief history. I've been involved in one way or another in education for a long time, that being that my father was on the Roseburg School Board for 20 years and actually served on the State Board for 10, and at one point in time was chairman of that board. And he would relay to me what they were doing and what they weren't doing. And one of the things I found most interesting was when he was chairman of that board, after an election of a new superintendent, and people will be nameless in this because there's no point, he went to that superintendent and said he wanted all of his contact numbers in case he needed to reach him. And the response he got from that superintendent was, "I'm not accountable to you." And in real terms, that's absolutely correct. The superintendent of public instruction is elected by the people, and that is the level of accountability. Now, fast forward to the last decade, when I spent most of that decade on this committee and dealing with the various issues in education, both K-12, community colleges, higher ed, and developed a high level of frustration for the disconnects in the system. And we would talk about it, and we would ask for more cooperation, and then they would create a group that theoretically did it, but in my opinion, it still has yet to happen. So I started thinking about that a few years ago. I said, what can we do to make this system better and make it a more coordinated system? And I've had many conversations with many teachers, superintendents, principals, any school board members. And the one thing that became apparent to me was that successful schools and successful school districts had one thing in common, and that is the CEO of the enterprise was good. And if you have a very good principal, they're going to empower the teachers and you will get a good product out of that school. If you have a very good superintendent, they're going to empower the entire enterprise. One thing both of those positions have in common is they are hired based on their qualifications to do a job. Now, clearly, there are other alternatives on the table at this point in time as to restructuring the top end of the education enterprise. I came to this solution based on the fact that I personally think, and Mr. Chair, the work you guys have been doing on higher ed is very good work, and I totally applaud that. And I think the governor's concepts on K-12 are also incredibly good and are going to bring fruit. But still, we have separate universes here. And my thought is that why we have these good, we have this level of organization, it would benefit us to have something above that that coordinated all those activities. So that's how I came to the concept of a K-20 board. And my K-20 board would be three members representing OUS, appointed by the governor, and three members representing community colleges also appointed by the governor. So the governor still has significant input into the enterprise. And then the five members representing K-12 would be elected, one for each congressional district, so that the people still have input into the enterprise. Now, there are some details yet to be worked out as far as qualifications to run for those offices, how the pool that the governor selects from is created, and all those things. But that's all very doable activities, and we can get that done. But the important point to me is that once we have created this Board of Education, that board hires the superintendent. And so it would give us the opportunity to get the most qualified person we could find to run probably the most important enterprise in the entire state of Oregon. And not only would it ensure that we had somebody of incredibly high quality, but the level of accountability would be back to the enterprise. Our education system is too important to play politics with. And the education system should be run by professionals who know what the system is and should be accountable to the people that know where the deficits are. Clearly, we can't divorce everything from politics, and clearly the governor is still going to have an important role to play, as are we. But it is time in this day and age when we're looking at transformation of everything under the sun. I think it is time to look at a brand new direction for our education enterprise and a level of accountability and a level of professionalism that will hopefully help us move the enterprise to the level of accomplishment we are all wanting to happen. So, Mr. Chair, I'm proposing this, and I know you're not moving things today, but it's time to begin the discussion. I've had discussion with many people in the building on this concept. Some are warming up to it, some are not, but I think it's a discussion that needs to go forward. I've had one conversation with the governor. I will be having others. I've had conversations with Nancy Golden, and I will have more with them, and I've talked to members in the House as well. So I think this is an interesting concept. I personally think it's a sound concept, and it's doing things not for political reasons but for good policy reasons, and I would urge your consideration of this concept, and I'd be willing to answer any questions.
Thank you, Senator. Questions, Senator George. Senator Cruz, you and I have had a number of conversations about this, and so you're under your proposal, it takes a vote of the people.
Yes.
So do you see anything conflicting with the idea of the committee moving the Senate Bill 552, which just designates the governor, at least to get us going in a direction? Because right now the status quo, people are really unhappy with. So do you see any conflict with moving the one that changes the status quo and then in the future giving the citizens the right to change it further if they want to?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, I'm not opposing any concept at this point in time. I guess my hope would be that this committee would consider potentially sending both over to the House. I think that the time to make a change is now, and I think we ought to be very careful to make sure that that whichever direction we go is going to be the best for the enterprise and not necessarily taking the easiest pathway. I would submit, Ms. Chair, Senator George, that it's quite likely that my concept would have the sort of support that would make it very likely that the people would accept it. And so I would hate to blunt that by doing something else. My perfect solution would be let's ask the people on this. If they reject it, we have the alternative to come back to. But that's a decision you all are going to make.
Thank you.
Thank you. It was nice to see you again.
Too. Miss you up on this side.
Well, maybe in a couple years.
Okay, anyone else signed up? I have nobody signed up on SGR 4, 170, or 552. So I'm going to close the public hearing on those three bills. And I'm going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 552. Linda, you want to, if you can summarize and tell us what the amendment does?
Senate Bill 552 designates the governor as superintendent of public instruction, requires the governor to appoint a deputy superintendent of public instruction, and specifies required qualifications of the deputy superintendent. It allows the governor to become superintendent upon the expiration of the term of the current superintendent, or if a vacancy for any cause occurs on or after the effective date of this act. The amendment declares an emergency, and the act would take effect on passage.
Right, and I think from talking to the sponsors, Senator Edwards and others, that the purpose of the amendment is in case the superintendent were to leave early, would leave, and this law passes, there would be kind of a limbo there, and this takes care of that. So, there we are. We are in a work session, Senator Nelson, on Senate Bill 552.
Great. Sorry for getting pulled out. Are you ready, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the -1 amendment to Senate Bill 552, dated February 11, 2011.
Senator Morris moves to adopt the -1 amendment to Senate Bill 552, dated February 11th. Any discussion?
You answered my question with the explanation. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any objection? The amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 552 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morris moves Senate Bill 552 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
As amended. Senator George.
Mr. Chair, I asked Senator Cruz on the record if he saw any conflict between this bill and his proposal. And I understand where Senator Cruz is trying to go. He's trying to even add a little more democracy to it and spread out the power. And I don't disagree with what Senator Cruz's his proposal is. And so I actually think the two things could go forward. This is a first step, I kind of feel like. And that's all it is. And I think Senator Cruz should continue to work on his idea and refine it and do those kind of things. And so I'll be supporting this bill, but just as simply as a first step to get us to some place where we can have an additional conversation about who should have impact on the superintendent of public instruction for the state of Oregon. Thanks.
And thank you. Further discussion? Seeing none, the clerk call the roll.
Senator Bonamici?
Aye.
Senator George?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Vice Chair Morse?
Aye.
Chair Hall?
Aye. Senate Bill 552 passes to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Senator Edwards will carry the bill.
Okay.
Moving on down the list. 602. 602
is here.
We'll open up a work session on Senate Bill 602. If you remember, colleagues, we had about half the Senate in here testifying on that one. Summary, Linda?
A quick summary is Senate Bill 602 requires the instruction of Oregon Studies in grade 6, 7, or 8 for a minimum of 2 semesters to take effect July 1st, 2012.
And committee, you saw the fiscal analysis, which says this is indeterminate. But one of the reasons it's indeterminate is because there's been a challenge in getting information from the department.
And the division, districts mostly.
And from the school districts, that's right. Mm-hmm. So, Senator Morris, we're in a work session.
I move Senate Bill 602 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morris moves Senate Bill 602 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really enjoyed the hearing on this bill, and I thank the sponsors for bringing it forward. I think Oregon history and civics is a critical part of education. In fact, I'm working with Representative Gene Wisnett on a couple of resolutions, one dealing with civics education and one dealing with personal financial education. If we had our hearing in the House Education Committee, we actually are working on amendments as we speak on those resolutions because they were drafted as required courses. And Representative Dembro brought up in the committee that we're really working toward proficiency-based education. And so we're working on recognizing that change in education on those couple it's a HJR 24 and HJR 36. I support this concept. I have very mixed feelings about what we're doing in terms of moving this. I believe the implementation date is 2012, which means that for the next school year, we'd be putting an additional 2-course requirement on middle school students that hasn't existed previously. And as important as this is, I'm trying to figure out how we're going to do that in terms of having the curriculum ready. I also would like to hear from, and don't think we heard from, the middle school teachers and schools about how they're going to structure or restructure their school day. I want students to learn Oregon history, but are they going to give up something else? Are they going to have to give up an elective? Are they going to add a period to the day? I don't know what that is going to do to the school day for students. I know that currently it's taught in a different level in elementary school, and this is moving it to middle school. So I don't really have a full understanding of the ramifications on the middle schools from this. So I really respect the senators who brought this forward. I thought the testimony was great. I just am uncomfortable with the time frame of implementing it by next year and without having enough information about how the middle schools are going to make the transition, Mr. Chair. So those are my concerns.
Okay. Further discussion? Senator George?
Mr. Chair, just could echo exactly what Senator Bonamici just said. We've been working really hard to eliminate mandates, and then we're turning around and putting a mandate back on. But I think that the testimony from those who advocated for it sort of put into context that perhaps this is a workable proposition. I guess I have a lot of reservations, but I'm hoping that those people who are dealing with middle schools and such will continue to work this bill as it moves over to the House and possibly put in some things that are less, I guess, less onerous on the schools at this point. Obviously, that the senators who brought this bill before us have great intentions and have a really important reason for doing this bill, and I don't want to discredit what they're trying to do. But at this point, I share the concerns of Senator Bonamici. I'll support the bill, but I have grave concerns about putting on a mandate right now on any K-12 education institution.
Further discussion?
There's a clarification, Mr. Chair.
Senator Morris.
when the reference is the 2012-2013 school year, that means beginning September 2012. Is that correct? Just for the record, right. Clarification.
Let me see. It does take effect July 1st, so the 2012 through 2013 school year would be the one affected.
Mr. Chair,
school year beginning September 2012. Mm-hmm. That school year.
Mr. Chair, it actually says that in the bill.
Yes.
Right.
But I just want to clarify it wasn't the beginning of the calendar year.
Oh, okay.
School year.
The school year. So there would be time to prepare that, to incorporate that in the curriculum. And if, you know, and if there is some concern about that, we could encourage the House to consider a later adoption date.
And I would just add that, you know, our educational system is always a living, breathing work in progress. We're removing many mandates through Senate Bill 800. Thanks to Senator Bonamici, and another bill that's coming up behind that, Senate Bill 560, and this is how it rolls. Sometimes is take something away, add something new, and there is, as we all heard, there was a strong sense in this building to teach more Oregon history, and I think that's what we're saying with this bill. So we have a motion. With no further discussion, the clerk will call the roll.
Senator Bonamici?
Yes.
Senator George?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Vice Chair Morse?
Yes.
Chair
Hatch? Yes. Senate Bill 602 passes with a do pass recommendation, and we'll have Senator Verger carry this bill on the floor. And we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 602. Colleagues, thank you for your patience. We have, I'm told, very quick business with these department bills. Are we at that place?
24 through 27.
24, 20, and 27. Let's start with the public hearing on Senate Bill 24. Cindy Hunt is here, and we'll just take them one at a time and maybe dispatch with them. Quick summary, please.
Yep. Senate Bill 24 eliminates alternative methods by which students may satisfy mathematics or English requirements for the high school diploma, declares an emergency.
Good afternoon. I'm Cindy Hunt from the Oregon Department of Education, and I'm going to quickly go through these bills. So Senate Bill 24 is removing some language that was enacted by the 2005 legislative session. And this language is unclear the way that it is in the statute. There's two different readings of the statute right now. It's either that if a student has demonstrated that they have met the essential skills in math and English, they get an Oregon diploma, regardless of if they've met science, PE, second languages, etc. Or it's that if they've met the essential skills in math and English, then they don't have to have the 4 and the 3 credits of math and English, and then they get the diploma. When the State Board engaged in rulemaking around the statute to clarify, to take the second interpretation, we heard from a number of school districts that saw this as being harmful to students. Essentially, if the students are given these credits, they're generally given them in their freshman or sophomore year. That means that they're not taking upper-level English courses and math courses. Additionally, since the time of the enactment of this particular provision in the Oregon Diploma Statute, the State Board has also adopted a rule on credit by proficiency, and I think Senator Bonamici spoke about credit by proficiency in one of your prior bills. And so this allows those students who have demonstrated proficiency through alternative means and seat time to be able to get credit, but the rule goes into more detail, so it's more thoughtful credit. It's not just based on whether or not they passed one test, which isn't necessarily aligned to the types of credits that they could get. So, in a nutshell, this bill removes just that language that is vague and we think that would ultimately actually hurt students, and addresses the school district's concerns as well. And with that, I'm open to any questions.
And the deletion of the confusing language is on line 25 to 30 on the first page?
Correct.
Okay. Questions? Is there anyone else here to testify on Senate Bill 24? If not, I'm going to close a public hearing on Senate Bill 24 and open up a work session on Senate Bill 24.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 24 to the Senate floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Senator Morse moves Senate Bill 24 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, Senate Bill 24 moves to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. We'll just start up ahead of the class again. Senator Bonamici, would you like to carry this bill?
I will. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. We don't have 25.
We do.
We do have Senate Bill.
Yes.
I'm going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 25.
And we may have some testimony on that.
Senate Bill 25 allows children 0 years of age or older who are not kindergarten children to be eligible for Oregon pre-kindergarten programs, declares an emergency effective on passage.
Okay, here we have Cindy.
Again, Cindy Hunt, Oregon Department of Education. In the 2010 session, legislative leadership allocated an additional $1 million for early Head Start, which includes children who are 0 to 3 years of age. At that time, there wasn't necessarily time to adjust the statute to catch up with the legislative intent. So Senate Bill 25 adjusts the statute so that it's now 0 to age 3 is included so that this to catch up with this legislative intent. We also would estimate that this change would impact approximately 30,000 children across Oregon. And so with that, we ask for your support.
Questions? Senator Morse?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you elaborate, Cindy, on why we moved from 3 to 0?
Chair Haas, Senator Morse, in 2010, I believe the advocates for this successfully advocated for moving to expand this program. There is a lot of studies and other, you know, good information out there that if we can do these early interventions and so forth with kids at a younger age, that the impact is, you know, triple, quadruple as they age. And so the legislature in 2010 allocated an additional $1 million for this particular age range. And so this bill implements that legislative intent.
Senator George?
With additional 30,000 children eligible and only $1 million, how does that work?
Chair Haas, Senator George, the money is allocated based on a slots basis, anyway, and it's divided across the state based on the providers. And I know that with allotment reductions and that kind of thing that's happened since that money was allocated, that we have seen some reductions in that. But it's allocated based on a formula, and I know that the providers are very grateful for this extra money.
Senator George?
If we took that $1 million and instead allowed additional student or additional children between 3 and 5 additional slots, would those slots be filled up? I mean, do we have slots available left right now? I mean, before we expand the down to infants, it seems like to me that 3 to 4 year old range should be maximized.
Chair Haas, Senator George, there are additional needs in the age range that's from 3 to 5 or K to 12 across our education system. That is definitely the case. However, to be clear, this bill implements the decision of the legislature from 2010 to put an additional $1 million into the birth to 3 year old children. This bill itself doesn't appropriate the additional money.
Oh,
you.
I am an advocate of Head Start. But the issue that Senator George raised in terms of where to put these resources, I'm not sure that was the will of the Assembly. It may have been the decision in the appropriation process. It didn't find its way into statute. And now we're catching up to it. And I question the wisdom of applying these resources to children that are newborn and in an environment that I'm not just sure what the program would be other than a nursing program.
So. It's funny, you said newborn, and I would have said newborn over the phrase children 0 years of age. There's something about that 0 years, I don't know why it runs. All right, maybe we go back to the drawing board on this one, Cindy, and kind of detect that on this bill.
Yes, Chair Haas, in answer to your zero question, early childhood statutes use the term zero, and that was, I believe, a compromise.
Okay.
So this is very consistent with those other statutes.
Good. Okay. Thank you for correcting me there. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 24. And
that was 25.
I'm sorry. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 25. Mm-hmm. And we're going to move on to opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 26. Quick summary.
Senate Bill 26 eliminates option for private or secondary schools to be registered with the Department of Education, declares an emergency.
And we have a couple of people. We'll start with Cindy Hunt.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, currently private schools are allowed to register with the Oregon Department of Education, but they're not required to register. The bill in front of you, what we're proposing to do is to remove the mandate on the department to register private schools. We estimate currently that there's approximately 367 private schools that are registered with the Department of Education, and essentially we're moving forward with this bill because we see it as a cost-cutting measure in anticipation of budget reductions. This would save the department about $100,000 per biennium. The registration of private schools, I think, is often viewed as something that adds to the quality of the schools, but because they're not required to be registered, there isn't necessarily, like if they violate one of the standards, there's nothing that we can hold over their heads. It's just non-registration. Some of the standards that are currently applied is that they have to offer the same number of instructional hours and consistent subjects as public schools and that kind of thing. But again, it's not required that they register, so they're not required to meet these standards. With that, I'm open to any questions.
Okay. This could be your remove the mandate bill, Senator George. We do have someone else signed up. Mark Siegel. Okay. Thank you for your patience in sitting through eight bills before you got to your bill.
My pleasure. Thank you, Chair Haas and committee members. And my students from the Delphian School are learning a lot, so appreciate that. I represent the Oregon Federation of Independent Schools, and we support this legislation, and I just wanted to let you know that we did, because you probably want to hear from us. You've seen us over the years. Unfortunately, we understand why it has to go away. We've appreciated this relationship, but also the developments within teacher standards and practices, the purpose for which the law was originally created to help private school teachers maintain their teaching license. That requirement went away when they changed the regulations in that regard. So its original purpose went away. It began to link itself to other benefits to private schools, and I'm assured that all the places where those recognitions went into place are now covered by just recognizing Oregon private schools will get those benefits. So our only concern, which we've discussed with the department, which I outline in my letter, are two. One, what do we do when parents and folks want to know about private schools in Oregon, so the department has assured me that we'll put something on the webpage to explain this development, that just because you've never heard from us and we don't register doesn't mean there's anything wrong. It won't have a negative effect. And also under the budget, we're concerned about where phone calls will go when people ask about private schools or starting a school or those kinds of things. And after session, I've been assured we'll have some conversations so that those will be addressed. So sharing the same concerns that you do as Oregonians and budget cuts and so forth, I guess the one plus will be that our private schools will continue to work hard to serve different populations and meet different needs of Oregon families, and they'll have a little less paperwork to fill out, and they can spend more time with their students and their families.
I very much appreciate your testimony and seeing the need we have in this stage.
Our pleasure.
Being a good sport, I guess, is really what it comes down to. Any questions or comments? Okay, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 26 and open up a work session on Senate Bill 26.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 26 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morris moves Senate Bill 26 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection? Seeing none, Senate Bill 26 passes with a due pass recommendation to the Senate floor. And Senator George, would you carry this? All right, he will. We do not have enough time to chew into Senate Bill 27 today. We're going to get kicked out of this room, so we'll have to carry it over. Apologies to people who are possibly waiting for that. Thank you all, committee, for a productive day. We are adjourned.